Okay, cool. Good morning. I'd like to introduce a project about the One Laptop Per Child project. The project is After the Hype, and with me here is our guest, Christoph Deyendorfer. Please give him a wonderful welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'm actually surprised to see that many faces given the early hours of the day and considering how many people were still hanging out in the Hacking Center at 4 a.m. this morning, me being one of them. So if there's any mistakes on the slides, you can blame it on the sleep deprivation, okay? The title of the talk is After the Hype, the Current State of One Laptop Per Child and Sugar Labs. Just a second about myself. I'm a computer science student at Vienna University of Technology, and I'm also researching for a small NGO that's working within the context of ICD and climate change and energy consumption. And I've been involved with One Laptop Per Child for almost 3 years now, mainly via two entities, one of them being OLPC Austria, a small nonprofit organization that we founded in Vienna that supports the project, and allpcnews.com, which is the largest independent blog talking about the project. You can see my email address and Twitter account up there in case you care. One thing that I want to say here early on is that I can't actually speak for any of the organizations I'm talking about, so everything I'll share in the next 45 minutes or so are my thoughts only. It's important to realize about very distributed and complex projects like One Laptop Per Child and Sugar Labs that those are very distributed and diverse projects with hundreds of people being involved in many countries around the planet, and it would be very presumptuous for myself to say that I can actually speak for any of them. So, as I said, please take everything I say here with a grain of salt and realize that it's my opinion only. I've structured the talk into three parts. The first one is the history of One Laptop Per Child and Sugar Labs. The second is the current status quo, so what is really happening. And the third one is what can FLOSS communities, what can hackers, what can people who care about open source, about open education, and who are also generally trying to interested in make the world a better place, if you will, what can they do to support the project. So part one, a little history or how the hype got started. If you want to boil things down as to why many people know the project and know those laptops, it's for this simple slide. The $100 laptop, a cute green machine with a hand crank, introduced in 2005, and that's pretty much the picture that everybody has in mind when they hear OLPC, or $100 laptop, or one laptop per child. But how was the project really created and started? First of all, I think it's important to realize that even though it's called One Laptop Per Child, it's really an ambitious education project. At least tries to present itself like an ambitious education project. The project itself was started within the area, so to say, of the MIT in Boston, Massachusetts. But what's important to realize that ideas and thoughts about how to use digital technologies for learning with very young children have been around for ages. In fact, if you look at the history of what we now know as portable computing and notebook computers, that actually directly derives from thoughts in the early 60s about how to use digital connected tools for education with very young children. So a lot of, or let's put it this way, one of the reasons why we're actually sitting around with laptops here is because people thought about how can we use connected devices? And it ended up being a business machine in many cases, but the thoughts and the theoretical concepts have been there for quite a while. One Laptop Per Child itself was founded in early 2005 as a nonprofit organization in Boston. The main guy who's also associated with the project is Nicholas Negroponte. He's one of the co-founders of the MIT Media Lab, and he's also known as one of the very early funders of Wired magazine. And definitely a very well-connected, influential, and visionary guy. In terms of the project development, the first prototypes of the machines that you see here were released in late 2005. Those are the pictures with the yellow hand crank that you saw before. And the mass production of the unit started approximately 2 years ago in November 2007. What's important is if you look at one laptop per child, if you look at the website, if you look at discussions, there are always five guiding principles that you will find, and hence I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about them. The first one is child ownership. Child ownership meaning that the laptops that are being distributed in this project are really meant to be owned by the children. It's not something that's stuck in a computer lab, that's shared with other people. Each child gets their own laptop and owns it. That also opens possibilities of learning outside of school, because people can use the laptops on the weekends, during the holidays, after school, and so on and so forth. Second point is low ages. Especially if you look at so-called laptop classes and laptop projects in Austria, Germany, and Switzerland, a lot of the efforts have focused on secondary school or even university. The key here is with one laptop per child, people are really trying to address what's primary school in most countries around the world. So age about 6 to 10 or 11. So very low ages. The third term is saturation. Saturation basically means that people are serious about the concept of one laptop per child. One laptop per child in a given city, in a region, preferably in a country, and, you know, if we're having a daydream, literally all around the world. So again, it's not about sharing those devices, it's about everyone having access to such a device to begin with. Fourth point is connectivity. With the lack of connectivity that we've seen here 2063, especially yesterday afternoon, you sometimes realize that when you're not connected to the network, even the fanciest laptop or mobile phone or whatever is actually pretty useless. Because a lot of the things we do actually depend on sharing, on communicating, on gathering information from other places. So connectivity is really a key ingredient to what we understand as digital technologies today. And so the idea also with one laptop per child was to actually have those devices connected in one form or another as often and as much as possible. Fifth component is the use of free and open source software. The idea is not to create more Microsoft clones or drones, which is an interesting topic that we'll discuss in a bit, but really to make free and open platforms available to people so they can also customize it to their own requirements. For example, Microsoft would never offer their operating system in a language that's only spoken by, let's say, 500,000 or 600,000 people because that's on the market. But if you're interested in bringing software to those people, you can get together a team, a small project, and start translating for them. That's something that's happened, for example, in South America, where people have started translating the software that's running on these machines into Aymara, which is a language spoken by about 1.5 million people, mostly in the mountains in Bolivia and Peru. And that's something that you can fundamentally only do with having an open platform. As mentioned before, the name is actually really, really serious. Every child gets a laptop, and a special laptop, a nice laptop, a cute laptop. You've probably all seen the pictures. You can see the machines here. Some people in the audience are using them. And what's important about those laptops is that when a lot of people look at them and say, "Oh, it's a $100 laptop," they think, "Oh my God, this can only be a piece of crap." Because if you go out to Toys R Us and buy some kind of children's calculator or a small cute machine, it costs you $200, and you know it's not actually a laptop or computer, it's a very, very limited machine. So how can anybody claim to make a $100 laptop? Well, you can do that if you use a real high-tech approach to things. So the reason why this laptop is much cheaper, was original, also much cheaper than other platforms, was because it was just designed with other design criteria in mind. And I'd like to discuss some of them. One of them that's really interesting and that's really still breakthrough technology, in my opinion, is the display. The display allows you to switch between a regular color mode and a black and white mode, and the nice thing is you can read them in direct sunlight. So, you know, if you're sitting in a train, in a park, and you're in a coffee place, with most regular laptops, you actually can't see anything on a damn screen except for your own reflection. And I know in a lot of places around the world, there's actually no school building, so people are being taught in open areas, under a tree, whatever. So it's important to actually make the device readable in direct sunlight. This is what this display does. And I swear to God, I wish I had a chance to get that display into my $1,500 laptop here, because it's actually so awesome. If you haven't seen it yourself, you should really check it out after the talk. It's amazing stuff. Hardware specifications aren't really all that interesting now. The point being here is that one of the main design criteria was to use very little power, which of course led to the hand crank design that you saw in the earlier pictures. And I literally wish that I had a euro for every time I heard this question. Where is the crank? Hundreds of times, every time I'm around, just sitting in a train or giving a presentation or whatever, people think about the crank. And the reason why they think about the crank is not just because it's nice and to remember the picture, but the symbolism behind it. You can be independent. You don't need a power network. You don't need an AC plug or anything to be able to use a computer. You're independent, and with your own strength, physical strength, you can actually create the electricity that runs the computer. I mean, very nice symbolism there. The thing is, it never turned out to be that way. As you can see, there's no cranks here. Couple of reasons for that. The most important being that for children it's simply not feasible to have them like cranking 24/7 or even a couple of hours a day to produce the electricity. But what's important to realize that the laptop here still uses very little power compared to a lot of other machines, and that opens possibilities for alternative charging solutions. Solar panels being a popular one, or one that I find particularly cute, is this one which was recently done in Afghanistan. I think, you know, if I had such a device or other computer geeks had such a device, that probably wouldn't be detrimental to our health either. So just a very nice way of again, generating power. Other people in India have done things where they've basically gotten a couple of cows together and they put them in some kind of wood construction, and the cows walk in a circle all the time, and in the middle you get a generator and that produces electricity for a classroom. So really thinking outside the box and completely new capabilities that are only possible due to the low power consumption of those devices. What's also important when you talk about designing something for children, especially for young children, is it's got to be very robust. People will drop it at one point or another, and if you're out in the middle of Rwanda, in the mountains of Nepal, or somewhere in the jungle in South America, there's no 0800 number that you can call and say, guys, can you fix my machine? It just broke. I mean, that won't happen. So it's been designed to be very robust in mainly three dimensions. The first one being humidity and water. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily shower with the thing, but there are videos of people using the laptop in pouring rain for 2 hours and the whole thing still working. Next one is dust, because in a lot of places, especially in Africa and South America, dust is actually one of the biggest enemies of computers, because you've got fans that are spinning and you get dust sucked into the machines, you've got dust buildup, fans failing, temperatures rising, electrical shorting, and so on and so forth. So the idea here was to use a almost sealed enclosure that doesn't have a fan, so you hardly get any dust inside. So those machines are just much more robust when you're lying on the beach or whatever. And the third thing is that, you know, you can quite easily drop it and things generally don't happen and break. I'm not going to explain how this happened, but sometimes things do go wrong. The nice thing about the whole device is that the way it's built up is it took me about 10 minutes to replace the screen with an additional screen, yeah, that I just had lying around. Because if I were to break the display on my laptop here, I would basically have to void warranties and have to rip things apart to get the display, and I might get the whole thing apart, but I would never have a chance to making the whole puzzle fit into one machine again. Yeah? So the internal structure of the device is also meant to be easily repairable. And in fact, I've actually seen 8-year-olds replacing keyboards, displays, whatever. The nice thing is that if you've got two broken computers with one of them having a failing screen and one of them having a failing keyboard, you can actually put them together and have at least one working machine again. So that's quite important. Now, when we come to the whole hype cycle, one of the things why people actually started listening to Nicolas Negroponte when he started talking about the project, and especially why the IT industry was kind of nervous, let's put it that way, when Nicolas Negroponte announced the project, is that he was talking about an initial start of the project of about 10 million units. And 10 million units in the notebook sector in 2005, that was quite a significant chunk of the global market. Yeah? Especially if you're reaching a market of very young people that would have no chance of getting a regular laptop. Because, you know, back in 2005, a laptop actually cost a whole amount of money. Thousands of dollars in some places. So what Nicholas Negroponte said initially is that he's not going to start the production of the machine unless 10 million units have been ordered. Well, that turned out to be, kind of a mistake, and he realized that step by step he'd have to get down that number because nobody in their righteous mind was willing to spend, I don't know, a couple of hundred million euros and dollars on an unproven project, especially when you're sitting in a poor country. So I'll talk about some of the numbers later on, but just to give you a dimension, after 2 years of this device basically being available to countries, about 1 million units of them have been sold and are actually being used by children right now. What's also important is that the project is still primarily known as the $100 laptop, and it receives a lot of critique and bashing, both in blogs, the regular media, online media, for not having met the target. In fact, the current price is about $188. But again, considering that in 2005 we didn't have netbooks, we didn't have devices available for $300, $350, $400, you can really credit OLPC for having invented a whole new category of inexpensive computers and devices. And I don't think I'm going out on a limb when I say that we simply wouldn't have the netbooks that many of you are using today if it went for OLPC and this crazy idea of doing a $100 laptop.
You think it's announced a $75 thing now?
I'll get to that in a bit. Now, what's important is I also talked about the hype and misunderstandings in media, and, well, not only misunderstandings, but sometimes also misrepresentation. One of the most important stories of 2008 was the so-called Microsoft deal, where it was announced that this machine, the XO1, which up to that point was only able to run a customized Linux operating system, would also be available with a Windows XP operating system. And people went nuts. Two of the main people which have been quoted in all those stories, in hundreds of stories actually, are Walter Bender, who used to be the lead in terms of software architecture at OLPC, and Ivan Kristic, who I'm not sure whether he's in the room, but at least he's at the event here, who used to do the security stuff. And the thing is that both of those individuals and a lot of other people got very, very frustrated by this perceived move away from one of the five core principles of OLPC, which is free and open source software. So, not surprisingly, there was an immense loss of goodwill from various FLOSS communities. In Austria, we also had people who dedicated, you know, a year of their spare time working on projects and efforts related to OLPC, suddenly questioning whether, you know, they'd been deceived or, you know, whether it was all still worth it. And a lot of people actually turned their backs on the project at the time. Now, the interesting thing is, of course, that according to everything we know today, out of the about 1 million units or laptops that are out there in the hands of children, only several hundred, at the maximum, worst case, a couple of thousand of them actually use Windows XP. So that's neglectable. But then again, it also shows how a marketing stunt by a company like Microsoft can actually really derail FLOSS projects. And that's definitely something to keep in mind. What is interesting, however, because, you know, all bad things also got the good sides to it, is that a result, an organization called Sugar Labs was created. Sugar generally is the software running on those machines, and while a lot of people just perceive it as a very different user interface for people, it's actually much more than a user interface. So it wants to be much more than a user interface. It wants to be a learning platform targeted at very young children, and again, very young children that might live, or actually most of them do live, in a very different social and cultural context than all of we do. So what's also important about Sugar Labs and the Sugar software is that, again, they're very much focused on free and open source software. It's an independent organization since mid-2008, because a lot of people who were frustrated with OLPC started their own organization, started their own community, and actually started getting things done. And what's important is that especially initially, the Sugar Labs folks and the project was very much focused on hardware independence. Because early on, Sugar was only, you could only run Sugar if you actually had one of those machines. And especially initially, they were in very short supply. And so what Sugar Labs has done now is actually make them available on a lot of other netbooks, a lot of other platforms, a lot of other Linux distributions, and even on a USB stick. Just a couple of words about Sugar, because I assume a lot of you here haven't yet seen it. What are some of the core concepts behind Sugar? One of them is collaborative learning. So the possibility, basically, to do everything that you're running, that you're doing on your machine, on your learning device, in a collaborative manner. So you can share a text document, basically, and two people can write on the same that text document. You can exchange photos, you can compose music, you can read books together, and so on and so forth. If you look at most other operating systems available today, most of those sharing and collaboration and social networking and 2.0, whatever you want to call it, is actually just a kind of bad bolt-on. You know, it's not tightly integrated into operating systems. Most of the operating systems we use today are still very much based in this original single-user experience in an office environment. I never thought about children doing things together under a tree in Nepal, for example. What's also important is this notion of learning by making or learning by doing. So instead of trying to teach people how to use Word or Excel or FrontPage or Dreamweaver or whatever you want to call it, it's about really making digital tools available for learning. So again, one of the important things, of course, within learning is reading, writing, painting, composing music. So creativity is an important aspect of the whole thing. And you can also write small little programs. There's integrated learning environments on the laptops, such as eToys, which you can use to actually create learning lessons yourself and experiment with things like gravity. There's a tool on the laptop that's called Measure that's very cool. First of all, you can measure any input that's coming in via an audio signal, but you can also measure sensory input on those devices like temperatures, like voltage, like light intensity, and so on and so forth. So it's actually a very versatile machine that actually does quite a bit more than some of the 200 euro Texas Instruments calculators that some of us use at university or have used at university. Just a couple of quick screenshots. This is the main home view in Sugar, so basically what's most closely associated to a regular desktop. All those icons in the circle are different activities or basically programs that I can use on a machine. And what's important is that within the context of Sugar and also OPC, obviously, people don't talk about applications. Because what's an application? In a lot of old languages, such as Aymara, which I mentioned before, the concept of an application doesn't exist. If you tell your grandmother about an application, I mean, she's not going to know what it is, really. So what they focused on here is the concept of an activity. Because an activity exists everywhere. So instead of calling something Microsoft, blah, Word, OpenOffice, and so on and so forth, the activity to write text is called write. The activity to browse the internet is called browse. The activity to take pictures and make video and audio recordings is called record. Just one of those details that really shows that the people have gone a long way in trying to make it a lot easier for people who live in a very different cultural context to actually understand what's happening here and basically make it easy for them to use digital tools. What's also important is that instead of having Nautilus or an Explorer or whatever to access your data that's stored in the machine, you've got something called the journal. Again, the concept of a journal or diary is something that's much more widespread than files and folders or whatever. And also, if you think about where files and folders come from historically, that's of course because of office automation. Because initially, a lot of computers were just used for office automation. Yeah? And what really the concept of a file and folder that's coming out in office from the 60s in some lawyer's office in the US is really the best way to teach a six-year-old in Ghana about how to store and retrieve digital objects. It's an interesting question. And also, what's interesting about this aspect here is that, for example, now the GNOME desktop is also thinking about integrating some of those journal aspects. Just a different way of again, storing and retrieving digital objects. I briefly mentioned creativity and exploration before, so that's a very simple program for making music. I'm personally not very good at that, and whenever I try to create something, it sounds pretty horrible. But I've seen a lot of young kids around the world actually coming up with pretty neat music. And especially because you can combine it with, you know, things that you can record in your environment. You could, you know, record an instrument somewhere and then actually sample it and make nice music out of it. I had also mentioned collaboration. So this is another important view within Sugar. It's the so-called neighborhood view. And it basically shows you all the other people in your environment that actually also use an XO. So the colleague sitting there with his battery running low, if I turned on my laptop, I would actually see him. And if he were interested in sharing his notes, so that he could share those notes, and I could immediately start typing them, correcting something, asking questions, or whatever. So again, basically, once you're within an environment, and that also happened yesterday when the Wi-Fi was working, is I turned on the machine, and there were like three other XOs in the environment. I didn't know who these people were. Where I tried to invite them to a chat session and talk to them. They didn't react, I don't know. But it's actually good to see which other people can actually using this, the same system and who you can collaborate or play whatever with. I'd also briefly mentioned Sugar on a Stick. So all of the software I'm showing here is not tied to this machine anymore. You can actually just go to www.sugarlabs.org and you can download a USB stick version of the operating system and just start it within a virtual box on your regular machine, on your laptop, on a thin client system, whatever. Now what's important again, and I hate to go back to that, to Microsoft, is that sometimes Microsoft itself actually doesn't need to do the dirty work of confusing people, because sometimes entities like the Free Software Foundation step in and actually do the work for them. I assume quite a few of you have seen the so-called Windows 7 Since campaign, which the FSF started in summer of this year. And under education, they actually listed OLPC as, well, probably a despisable project. And I'm quoting the original FSF text here. Negroponte, desiring the financial support of Bill Gates and Microsoft, ignored them being people like Walter Bender and even Chris Church, who warned about a move to proprietary software, and proceeded with his decision, the decision to make Windows XP available on the XO. As a result, it is expected that the main effect of the OLPC project, if it succeeds, will be to turn millions of children into Microsoft dependents. That is a negative effect to the point where the world would be better off if the OLPC project had never existed. Personally, when I read this, I just got very, very furious. I think it's just very presumptuous of well-off people sitting, you know, in Boston, another place around the world, to be able to presume that, you know, just their way of doing things is the best way for everyone. And to say, you know, we shouldn't connect millions of children around the world because they might use proprietary software, it's just totally presumptuous and arrogant in my opinion. What's interesting is here that, again, there was a big backslash in media, but for once, actually, a lot of people within the FSF realized that this text doesn't really make sense and doesn't really generally represent the good work and good spirit that's going on in the FSF, and they actually later changed it. But then again, if I were Microsoft at this point, I would be sitting in an office and laughing all day. Because, you know, I don't even have to draft up a press release to confuse the people and confuse the markets and get people turned off a floss project because the people do it themselves. So again, you know, don't just question the FUD coming from one side, but also what's happening on the other side. And now we can point that what was raised here before about future XO hardware designs. This machine here is an early prototype of the XO 1.5 that should start mass production within the next couple of weeks. The interesting thing here is it doesn't come with Microsoft on it, but rather again a Linux operating system, Fedora, with a regular Sugar desktop, and you can also easily switch to a regular GNOME desktop, which is quite interesting and works quite well. And it's upgraded hardware and quite a bit faster and should be available at the same price point. However, if you happen to check the online media, you know, over the Christmas time, it was kind of hard not to see this image. Yeah, ooh. The so-called XO3 for 2012 was announced. I mean, we don't have much more than CGI renders at this point. And I mean, if you, I don't know if you guys know the game Bullshit Bingo. But if one were to play Bullshit Bingo with a press release, I think just the first couple of lines of all PC's press release would be pretty awesome. Breakthrough advances, revolutionary, unprecedented high performance, lower and lower, I'm surprised I didn't say lower and lower and lower, cost, and so on and so forth. Yeah, innovation, of course, that's also an important aspect. Please take those kinds of information with a grain of salt, because first of all, predicting anything that's going to happen in 2012 is ridiculous to begin with. But I actually had fun with the whole thing. And so now, this is, get excited, this is world exclusive stuff. I can announce the XO10. It will actually produce electricity while in use. It won't just not cost anything, it will print money. It will fight climate change by consuming CO2. It will cure cancer, include the kitchen sink, the American folks always like that, and for you guys, it will brew glue part there. Turning back to reality, what's really happening right now? As I mentioned, at this very moment, more than a million children are using the XO and sugar on a daily basis for their learning, both inside school and outside school. It's hard to keep track because so many things are happening, but there's at least 30 countries around the world where all PC is active at the moment. And what you've got to realize again, that what's the larger context within which all PC is working? I've spent quite a bit of time now in the first part of the lecture talking about the technologies and laptops, but as I mentioned, it's really an education project. So, to put it frankly, and of course a bit oversimplified, I think one of the big issues with education generally around the world today is that children are being prepared for tomorrow using yesterday's methods. Again, if you look at the history of education, that's not really a surprise, because the last time that educational systems, especially in Asia, Western Europe, and North America actually underwent through big changes in industrialization. A lot of the issues that we're running into education right now are just very obvious if you look at this from this point of view. But then again, we really shouldn't complain, because if you look on a global level at primary education spending, and I'm not sure whether you know the project worldmap.org, but it's a very awesome website. It basically allows you to display the countries of the world in depending on different variables and input. For example, in this place, on this map, the countries are basically sized depending on how much money is spent on primary education in the respective countries. Again, no surprise that North America and Europe is quite bloated, whereas some parts of Africa aren't really visible. Put into numbers, this is what things look like. While on average about $3,000 is spent per student, so between age 0 and 15 in Austria, in Nepal it's only $68 per year spent on education. So there's a massive gap, which results in situations like this one, when a lot of lesser developed countries, the average class size in primary schools is more than 100 people. I mean, you really wouldn't want to be a teacher in that class, right? Question is, what do things look like tomorrow? I think what's important is to realize that it's hard, as I said before, to predict anything that's happening 2012, let alone 2020, but some core issues will definitely be that there will be jobs on a global market. Digitally connected devices will be a very basic tools of everyday living, of working, of learning, and you'll need 21st century skills. Skills that most of you in here have definitely an above average qualities and quantities, but for a lot of people, information literacy, critical thinking, innovation, sorry for the buzzword, creativity, open-ended problem solving, and technological fluency will be core skills to have in the future. And within this context, I think that David Cavallo, who's one of the education leads for all PC, saying that laptops are the pencil for the digital age definitely makes a lot of sense. Now, looking at the advanced time we have, I got to jump a couple of slides and go forward to looking at what's really happening in a lot of the countries that actually have subscribed to this concept and approach to education now. First one I'd like to talk about briefly is Uruguay. Just some brief information about Uruguay. It's a fairly small place, 3.5 million inhabitants, fairly rich, about 500 euros average monthly income, high literacy, and on the UN's Human Development Index, they're actually doing quite well. Uruguay has distributed more than or almost 400,000 laptops to children in the country right now. That means that every child in a government-run public school between the first and sixth grade in Uruguay has a laptop today. So again, taking the notion of one laptop per child pretty damn seriously. And if you look at the cost, what's important, of course, that you know, just the initial cost of the purchase of the machine isn't anything, isn't everything. You need to consider things like connectivity, like teacher training, like spare parts for repairs, and so on and so forth. They've calculated that the four-year TCO is about $276 per child. So, I mean, that's not nothing, and it's still way too expensive for a lot of places, yeah? But for a country like Uruguay, that is quite feasible. And again, to talk about the scale of the project there, I mean, they've got their own stamp featuring the EXO in Uruguay. More than 2,000 schools are involved, almost 20,000 teachers, 1,500 volunteers. There's a cooperation with the post office that basically allows everybody that if your EXO is broken, you can walk into any post office in Uruguay, say it's broken, they'll ship it to a repair facility and back to you free of charge. I mean, that's talking about scale. And there's a presentation at the link there that's quite interesting if you want to know more details. Another quick example I want to give is Nepal, especially because it's dear and close to my heart as I had the chance to spend my summer there. Quite a different country, almost 30 million inhabitants. Average monthly income is approximately 30 euros. Literacy is less than 50%. And on the Human Development Index, it ranks pretty badly. And load shedding, which means cutting off electricity for many hours a day and in some regions for even weeks, is a big issue there. Again, it included Nepal up on the earlier table, so that gives you a good idea of the issues that are also facing in education. Now, what's important is that in Nepal, there's an independent NGO called Oli Nepal that's working on implementing OLPC in the country. They're obviously closely collaborating with the Ministry of Education, and they're quite a sizable organization by now, having 35 employees, especially considering that they were only funded 1.5 years ago. So just a quick run through a couple of things that they're doing. EPAT, which are interactive learning activities, unfortunately done at the moment in Flash, for the three subjects which their laptops are used in Nepal for, which is English, Mathematics, Nepali. And what's important is not just that those are interactive learning activities, but they actually come with guidance documents to help the teachers actually use those digital learning activities within their classroom context. So that's a really important aspect. That's a screenshot of this there. E-Pustakalaya is a digital library, because in every school where Oli Nepal starts a project, they're actually installing a server which features this digital library with approximately, I think last time I counted, 300 or 400 books installed of them. So even, I mean, a lot of those places don't have internet connectivity at the moment, but they can still access 300 and in the future more books that are stored locally in the basically digital library of the school. Another very important project that they're working on at the moment is Karma, which is a FLOSS toolkit for creating interactive learning activities. This is just getting started. Version 0.2 was released, I think, 2 weeks ago. And it's based on HTML5 and JavaScript. And the idea is to get rid of Flash, because Flash has got a lot of issues, not just that it's proprietary, but, for example, that you can't use Nepali script. It's not natively supported in Flash. So every time in Nepal they actually want to include a text within a learning activity, they got to take a freaking screenshot and then paste the screenshot, because there's just no way to support things like that. Yeah. Very annoying, but you should check it out. It's at karmaeducation.org. And that's one of the screenshots there, a learning activity designed for Uruguay to learn about the geography of the country and about cities. Again, power being an issue in a lot of places, so they've designed simple charging racks, because in a lot of schools and those schools that I visited in Nepal, there's no AC power plug. It's just two blank wires coming out of the wall. And of course, you don't want to expose young children to that. So they've built simple charging racks that work really well and help keep the children safe. In terms of connectivity, they're trying to build up networks between the schools, and by early 2010, they actually want to have at least a 1 megabit connection to every school that they're using it, that they've started an OLPC project at the moment. So again, I mean, once you bring the connectivity to a school, of course the whole community can benefit from that, because children's got the devices, their parents can use them on the weekends or whatever, and you're just investing a lot of money and effort into building up the kind of infrastructure. Just to give you an overview, the project is quite a bit smaller compared to Uruguay, 2,200 XOs in 26 schools in 6 provinces at the moment. So it's taking a very different scale, which also shows that there's basically 2 ways to approach OLPC. One is traditional top-down governmental affair, like it's done in Uruguay, where Ministry of Education running the shots, and the other approach is, of course, more of a organically grown, bottoms-up approach, where grassroots and organizations and nonprofits work together to actually make things happen in the country, which, again, this approach seems or should be familiar to a lot of people. Now, what's, of course, also important is that it's not just in developing nations that things are happening. And this leads me to the last part of the presentation, which is what FLOSS and what FLOSS communities and programmers and people who care about education and open access to IT and education and content care about, what they can do. Within Europe, there's a couple of country organizations that have grown within the past 2.5 years and have started to work on things. Again, I had mentioned we started OLPC Austria. If you want to learn more about OLPC Germany, there's a guy in the background, back wearing a cap, who will be able to tell you more about it. There's also people here that deal with OLPC France, and in Switzerland there's also community. But of course that means there's a lot of places where a lot of countries where no community has started yet. So if you're interested, talk to us, and we'd love to add more countries to that list. Of course, it's not just Europe. 2 of the biggest organizations, grassroots communities in the US are based in San Francisco and Washington, D.C. And again, there's many more starting up. There are things going on in Boston, in New York, and so on and so forth. And again, I think if we put it to a core, what we as different communities and organizations want to do is developing educational tools in the form of open technologies, platforms, software, and content not only for developing countries. And I think that's quite a big scope of things that we're trying to do here. So one thing that's, of course, quite interesting to me personally is that we've got a small Austrian pilot project where 25 children in a primary school in Austria are actually using those laptops to learn, and in fact it was the first such project in Europe, which again goes to show that the whole idea of open IT and using laptops with very young children isn't just happening or of interest to people in poor places, so to say, but it's of course also very interesting to people in Europe. Just a quick run through of things that have been done so far. Those different communities and also individuals have helped translate software and documentation to French, German. I had mentioned Aymara in South America before. People have tested software, they've written learning activities for learning math, for learning about geography, about geometry, whatever. People have started pilot projects. Apart from Austria, another one is running in the United Kingdom, and actually I think in Berlin a small project is working as well. People have done a lot of important work on wireless networks and making it easier for people to get connected to the internet. There's, of course, people spreading the word, people are giving presentations, and so on and so forth. But what's, of course, also important is that more needs to be done. And what you generally need is what one of our friends at OLPC in Boston generally calls the 3 T's: teachers, technologists, and Twitterers. So really, it's hard not to fall into one of those 3 categories, but if you do think you're a different category, talk to us and we'll definitely figure out something that you can contribute. As I mentioned, for technologists, because I assume that's what many of you here are, software testing is an important aspect, writing of software, maintaining packages, networking stuff, etc., etc. And also to kind of paraphrase what was said in yesterday's keynote, And even if you don't care about education, politics, or development, there's just lots of interesting technical challenges that need to be solved and that people should really be working on. And, well, I hope it's you. Again, what's also important to realize is that all PC and Sugar Labs are just two of the efforts that are happening within this space. If you look at ICD for education at large, there's very interesting things and also open things going on, like connections, Coriki, to some degree less open, of course, ITunes University, but still open in the sense that now everybody can access, for example, lectures in Austria by the Technical University in Graz or by the University of Innsbruck. Before that, you had actually be subscribed or pay at university and go there. Now everybody with an internet access can watch those lectures. And of course, one of the prime examples is still MIT OpenCourseWare, which is just awesome in my opinion. And within ICT for development, there's also lots of other efforts going on. I've put up two of the most interesting ones in my opinion up there, one of them being Invenio, another one being Endio. If you're interested in that, we can discuss details later. So now that I've almost overdrawn my time already anyway, just some quick conclusions. Generally, don't believe the hype, and don't believe the counter-hype. Again, don't expect an XO10 to actually appear in a store near you anytime soon. And also, think about what the counter-hype is saying, because something that's just plain wrong. All PC and Sugar Labs is very much kicking and screaming in the life. Again, more than 30 countries around the world with active projects at the moment. Dozens of grassroots communities in Western Europe, North America, South America, and Asia. And more than 1 million children are actually using this technology and this software on a daily basis. And again, if you're interested and you come from a FLOSS background, you care about the openness of education, information, and digital tools, then there's lots of interesting things to be done within that aspect, even if you're not a teacher. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. Now we have about 15 minutes for questions. There's a microphone here, and there's also a microphone that side of the room. Please come up to the microphone to ask a question. And Christoph, if you could please repeat the question after you hear it, that'd be great. Thanks.
Well, this may be a stupid question, but it's always been kind of hard to buy one of these devices when you're from the West. What's the status in that?
Well, I mean, sorry, I got to repeat the question. The question was that it's always been hard to buy those devices when you're in a Western country and how to actually obtain one. In 2007 and 2008, and a lot of people know that, there were programs just before Christmas called Give One, Get One, where for approximately $400 that you donated, you donated one machine to somebody in a developing country and basically got one yourself. The program wasn't renewed for 2009, but what's important, and I probably should have actually mentioned it in the slides, is that something called All PC Contributors Program, if you just go to wiki.laptop.org and enter Contributors Program, that's a program where people who want to contribute to the project can apply for a laptop. Let's say you want to do network testing and you're interested in having 5 laptops because you want to test a new protocol or something. Then you can apply for 5 laptops, and within an open and transparent community process, it will be decided whether your efforts aren't worthwhile, and then you will be sent free of charge laptops, a laptop or laptops by all PCs, so you can actually start working on those things.
Can you say...
Okay, also vielleicht ganz kurz eben noch das, was der Beat von OLPC Deutschland gesagt hat, ist wieder so ein Punkt, gehört auch in die Folien eigentlich, dass zum Beispiel verschiedene Organisationen wie OLPC Deutschland, wie OLPC Frankreich oder auch wir in Österreich haben ein paar extra Geräte, die man einfach verleihen. Wenn irgendwer herkommt und sagt, hey, ich habe eine coole Idee für ein Projekt, könnte man den Laptop für 2 Wochen ausborgen oder für einen Monat, dann kann man diese Organisation herantreten und als sie einen Laptop ausborgen sozusagen. Danke, Bert.
Can you just say it in English?
Oh, English, sorry. Sleep deprivation, I apologize. What Bert has mentioned, that is a lot of places and a lot of communities like OLPC Germany, like OLPC France, like the guys in San Francisco and Washington, D.C., and of course in Boston, New York, and other places, have spare laptops. So if somebody's interested in checking out the laptop for a week, trying out new software, trying new hardware hack or whatever, you can approach those groups and they will generally send you a laptop or give you a laptop that you can experiment with for a couple of weeks or however long it's decided.
Is there a primary reason why it is so hard to buy one in Europe? I mean, $188 for me is funny money. My freaking mobile phone costs three times that much. And if I just want to go and buy one, that would probably rise the economies of scale and drive down the prices for everyone in the world. So I guess if every second person in this room or in this conference got one just for kicks of it, it would lower the prices.
That's of course an often raised argument. The thing is that if you're actually trying to sell stuff, I mean, literally sell things for money, especially in the European Union, I mean, you got to offer things like warranty, like support. That needs resources and money and so on and so forth. And also the thing is that with the status of a non-profit organization in the United States and all the same thing in Europe, there's only so many things you can actually charge money for. So it's a delicate balance. Maybe it would make sense to make it available on the regular market, but with the current organizational form and structures and also legal status, it's simply not possible. And just on a more philosophical aspect, I think there is indeed the danger also of kind of distracting or blurring the clarity of vision for OLPC, because it is mostly about education in developing nations. And if you start building up infrastructure and have legal entities in every country in Europe and so on and so forth, that might actually just eat a lot of resources and take away from the core mission, so to say. But it is definitely a valid argument, and maybe a different approach would be more reasonable. It's hard to say.
Can I make a suggestion to that? Why don't you sell it as a paperweight? Really just something that you put on a table to let paper not go. No guarantees, but it keeps the paper down.
I'm not a lawyer, but I think it's doing something like that might work in the US, but in no chance in hell that's going to work in Europe. Sorry.
Hi, that was a fantastic talk, and I think this project is amazing because I know this is the way I think technology can change the world, and actually not change like 1,000, but change millions and millions. And one interesting thing is like, what's your take? I don't know. Like, I think technology, I think it should be a part of, we should consider how can technology be adopted. But I don't think it's about a technological problem we have, but in terms of the world, but how people actually use it. And especially young children, you know, like, have you thought about any sort of problems of like in terms of sociological, anthropological perspective of how can actually they use this technology and how would it be better for their lives? You know, in that sort of way?
So. What's interesting is, I don't know if any of you saw the very awesome talk on hacker utopias that was given at 11 p.m. last night. But the thing is there that, how should I put it? Coming from a perspective with some of the technology background, I might not actually be the most qualified person to think about those issues. And there are lots of theories. Again, I mean, if we actually had one laptop per child, of course the world would be different. And I would hope it's better, but it's hard to say that. And I think a lot of it is just work in progress, and we'll have to see. Again, Uruguay is the first country in the world that actually has one laptop per child for all the primary school children. And I think instead of me speculating on what might happen, it's just more interesting to see what's happening there and actually letting people who actually get a clue about this issue actually observe it. I don't want to take too many guesses here, but of course I'm hoping it's positive in many ways. You could think about things like, you know, electronic health things. You could think about people not having to walk 12 hours to the nearest market to find out that the product they wanted to buy isn't there. You can think about things like warnings of a tsunami or whatever, or spreading health information once everybody is connected to a network in one way or another. And actually, at the end, it doesn't matter whether it's this machine or whether it's a mobile phone or whatever. And I think there's lots of interesting possibilities. And a lot of people are working in this space under, you know, ICD for development. But I think it's really early days, and we'll just have to see what happens there.
Okay, we still have time for some more questions, if anyone else wants to come up.
I do. Hello. I just want to say that it's just a really beautiful project, a really beautiful idea. I really like it. Fucking, can you just say ho? Hello. Just another applause. It's great. I mean, I really like it. It's a really, really beautiful idea. The thing is, what I didn't understand was, why you need people for Twitter?
Can you repeat that question?
No comment.
I have another question, which I actually forgot.
Okay, I hope I didn't forget mine. I'd like to know if the financial crisis turned out to be a serious problem for the whole OLPC project.
This is going to be what we call in German a Jein question answer. It's hard to say. On one level, yes, because early in or at the very beginning of January 2009, OLPC actually let go half of their staff because they were just literally running low on money. So of course, in the sense of a project that's trying to develop technology within the nonprofit sector, it certainly hasn't made life easier. But then again, some of the things that are actually happening in developing nations, regardless of whether it's Nepal, Peru, Uruguay, Rwanda, I mean, if you look at how things like developing agencies, how the World Bank and those kinds of organizations work, they've got a much longer perspective for things anyway. So it might be a bit harder at the moment to actually get money for a new project or something, but the things that are generally running seem to be doing okay so far because it's just a longer-term outlook that's not necessarily as impacted by short-term moves in financial or economic markets.
I got it back. So all that makes me a little bit afraid that we're in Europe going to be the developing countries in the future. And the question was, have you seen any unintended positive or negative consequences of your project? For example, parents borrowing the laptops while the children are asleep and setting up business with it?
I haven't heard those kinds of stories. One immediately observable impact in every country where I've actually talked to people or where I've heard stories is that school attendance in every school around the world where they've distributed those laptops go up. Because school is suddenly, again, perceived as something interesting, where things are going on. You got to realize in a lot of places, children aren't going to school because they have to work out in the fields or have to take care of younger siblings and whatnot. Because school isn't perceived as something very valuable to begin with. Because a lot of places, again, you saw the pictures, there's going to be 150 pupils per teacher, there's going to be no equipment and so on and so forth. So parents think, why bother? But now with this being a new and attractive thing, attendance definitely goes up. And what's also interesting is that if you look at very, very early social impact studies, so to say, is that it normally says that the coherence within classrooms and schools between the pupils is better. And in some places also the collaboration and the relationship between teachers and pupils also becomes better. Going further away, like with families and parents, there's lots of, you know, hearsay and stories. But nothing where I can see that, you know, people have independently confirmed that. But there's definitely lots of interesting things happening, yeah.
We have about 2 more minutes. Okay, if nobody else, I have a question. I am very interested in localization and usability, and I was wondering what resources the project has to localize the software and to possibly make it culturally relevant to students around the world.
In terms of localization, it's mostly done on a per-country basis. So people in Germany or Austria who want to have a German version of it translated to German, the same thing happening in India, in China, in South America. And it's mostly really just communities getting together and seeing, okay, there's a need because those things haven't been translated, and there's an open translation process and system in place at OLPC and Sugar Labs. So where all you actually have to do is, even if you've got just 10 or 15 minutes, you can log into a website, look at strings that haven't been translated and translate them. Someone will check if that makes any sense. And then that's basically put in the distribution and put into the software. So that's just on a language basis that's happening already. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so thank you. Enjoy the rest of the day.